I'm going to start with a premise, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the premise because I suspect everybody in the room shares it with me. And that is that we are living and operating politically in incredibly dangerous times. And as I say, I don't think I need to prove that to you. We need only to look at events of the last 10 days or so, particularly in the United States, but also the presidential elections in Brazil, to recognize what I'm talking about. Whether it's the massacre at the Tree of Life Synagogue, whether it was essentially racist execution of two African Americans at a Kroger store in Kentucky, whether it was the murderous rampage that a misogynist male in Florida engaged in on Friday at a yoga studio. The degree of danger that confronts everybody oppressed in late capitalist society, I think, stands in very, very powerful and sharp relief for us right now. So I'm going to take that as a starting point assumption. And I'm not going to spend a lot more time elaborating it because I think most of us are in a room like this, just like many of us were protesting Steve Bannon on Friday, because we're focused on what can be done about all of this. And I'm going to frame my remarks in reply to that classic what can be and what is to be done question, in terms of the interconnections among social regression, despair and anger, and political polarization. All right, is that easier? Okay. I mean, I won't exercise my vocal cords quite as much. Do I still need to yell? A little bit? Okay, I can do that. Let me explain what I mean when I talk about social regression, despair and anger, and political polarization. There was a turning point a decade ago that was generally called the global financial crisis. And with that crisis of 2008 and 2009, several things kicked in very rapid succession. They were all trends that you could see earlier, but they were accelerated and intensified and are producing qualitative shifts. Literally, the changes aren't gradual and molecular anymore. They're becoming rapid and qualitative. And what I mean is, on the one hand, the ruling class, through the central banks and governments, massively intervened to bail out the global financial system to the tune of something over $20 trillion. In the course of doing that, they deliberately implemented programs of austerity designed to cut social spending and working class living standards to effectively pay for the bank bailouts. And so we have been through now a decade of austerity. And by the way, when the G10 and G20 gathered in Toronto and Huntsville in 2010, their first term that they used in their documents was decade of austerity. They thought we were looking at 10 years. Then in the final communique, they scratched that out and wrote age of austerity. They recognized, in other words, that a decade might not be enough. And that declaration of a war against the poor, a war against the working class, was carried out in the first instance by many of the traditional parties of the political center. It was basically carried out under Obama, for instance, in the United States. It was carried out under Angela Merkel in Germany, and so on. They did not, in the first instance, often have the political parties of the right in power. They often had the parties of the traditional center to implement austerity. And this meant that as anger and resentment bubbled up about what was happening in ordinary people's lives, it was very, very easy to target and demonize the traditional political center, the traditional political elites, to talk about the swamp that needed to be drained, and so on. All of this so-called populist rhetoric, and I'm very, very cautious about using the terms, that's why I said so-called, happy to talk about that later, that targeted those elites responsible for the age of austerity. Trump was a master at this. And some of you may have seen the article today in The Guardian, for instance, where working class voters who voted for Trump are saying, well, where are the jobs? Like, we genuinely believe that's why we vote. We didn't like the guy, but we wanted the jobs back. And so that targeting of the center was by and large most successfully capitalized on by the right. Not exclusively, and I want to emphasize that, but it was largely capitalized by the right, and I'll say in a moment one or two things about that. But let me describe then what I mean by this translating into political polarization. Because as the center became the parties of austerity, the Democrats under Obama, the Christian Democratic Union in Germany under Angela Merkel, and so on, as those parties of the political center got targeted with austerity, parties of the political right were able to appeal to profound senses of alienation and despair, but the right always in the first instance has an advantage in capitalist society because their program and ideology cuts with the grain. Racism, misogyny, glorification of the patriarchal family, homophobia and transphobia, Islamophobia and anti-Semitism, all of that cuts with the grain of the dominant society. The left needs to be able to respond in ways that in a certain sense ideologically are not as easy. Now, there is something that we have in our favor in that regard that I'm going to come back to in a moment, but I don't want to underestimate that we do have some significant advantages in this scenario. But first, let me just describe what I'm talking about. Because it is polarization, and I want to emphasize this to the right and the left. It is not just an across-the-board galloping to the right. So, for Trump, there was also Bernie Sanders. And without Bernie Sanders, you literally do not get hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people in the United States today who self-identify as socialists. That campaign, and I'm going to talk a little bit about its most significant political outcome, which is the growth of the Democratic Socialists of America into a genuinely mass political formation. And I'll come back to that. So to Trump, there was Sanders. But of course, the Democratic Party establishment was never going to let Sanders get the nomination. And they pulled every dirty trick imaginable to make sure that did not happen. Once again, why? Because there's something about Sanders' politics, which are essentially social democratic. Don't anyone misunderstand that I'm saying, oh, you know, Bernie Sanders is a revolutionary socialist or anything like that. No, they're essentially social democratic, but they have elements of classical social democracy that cut against the grain, that require some notion of class opposition as being inherent to society. For the British case, of course, there is a significant radicalization around the Labour Party, represented by the election of Jeremy Corbyn as leader, and the influx of about 200,000 more members into the British Labour Party, because Corbyn staked out a very similar kind of political terrain to that of Sanders, that is to say, a more classical as opposed to neoliberal social democracy. The global trend of social democracy over the last 40 years has been to adapt to neoliberalism, to have social democratic political figures who try to break from neoliberalism, even within a social democratic framework, is to start to break out of that neoliberal lockjam. We saw the same thing in the last cycle of French presidential elections. Yes, it is absolutely true that the National Front under
Le Pen rose to about 7 million votes, and that is frightening and dangerous in all kinds of ways. But the left candidacy of Jean-Luc Mélenchon also drew about 7 million. Again, as a kind of independent left presidential candidate, pretty much positioned in the same kind of way that I'm describing Sanders and Corbyn. And in some cases, but not all, this has had some lasting political effects. I mentioned the 200,000 who are inside the Labour Party today, essentially on that party's left, trying to defeat the old Blairite neoliberals inside the Labour Party. And I would argue that the growth of the DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, in the US to something over 52,000 members is itself also an expression of the same kind of phenomenon. Nevertheless, as I said, the advantage that the right has is the ways in which they cut with the dominant ideology. Let's put it this way. We all know that on Friday night, Steve Bannon got invited to speak by the Monk Center affiliated with the U of T. And then you ask yourself, when was the last time a hard left individual got invited to speak by the Monk Center? Well, we could be here all day because you're not going to come up with one. Okay? And that's because of the fact that what Bannon says, even though we all know he was a central figure through Breitbart in the organization of the alt-right and the fueling of white supremacist and neo-Nazi organizing in the U.S., Bannon cuts with lots of the dominant ideology, and so he can be there, and we are very unlikely to get those kinds of invitations. That's the sense in which our work is harder. But I want to emphasize here that the socialist left also always has its considerable strength. And that is, to paraphrase the Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci, working class consciousness is never uniform. It is never moving in simply one direction. And Gramsci basically says to us in his famous notebooks written from prison in the 1930s when he was jailed under Mussolini, he says, look, working class consciousness is always contradictory. It is an amalgam of received dominant ideas. There's not a single one of us who has not been affected by the dominant ideas in this society. But the working class consciousness also has counter elements, he says, which are what he describes as the good sense elements, as opposed to the bourgeois common sense elements. And the good sense elements are those that are derived from practices of solidarity, from practices of resistance, from all the ways in which working class people in neighborhoods, communities, workplaces, schools, and so on actually create practices by which, rather than scratching out one another's eyes to get ahead, they actually collaborate, support one another, lend a hand, organize together, create collective responses that give them more power, and so on. And all of that good sense within working class consciousness is derived from those kinds of experiences, but it rarely has the same level of systematic expression that the ideas of the ruling class have, because the ruling class has institutions to develop systematic expression of their ideas. And that's where political organizations, mass parties, and social movements come in, because they need to be the laboratories in which working class good sense gets systematized so that it can literally counter and overcome the inherited ideas. And on this, I want to say something about a couple of debates on the left. Some of you will know that I spent some time in Germany earlier this fall. And I found myself, actually in the first instance, not intentionally, I found myself initially unintentionally, but once provoked, happily, in the midst of debates with people inside the left party, known as Die Linke, who have formed a current called Aufstehen, which basically means get up. Okay, and Aufstehen has taken the view that the left response to the rise of the Alternative for Germany, the AfD, the far-right party, which is advancing, which is around 20% in the polls right now. It is becoming a mass party on an Islamophobic, anti-immigration, far-right kind of politics. It's deeply dangerous. But the Aufstehen people have come along and said, we've got to stop emphasizing our support for immigrants. We must repudiate open borders. We need to start appealing to the workers who are drawn towards the Alternative for Germany on bread and butter economic issues and not fight with them, not argue with them around issues like immigration. And they, by the way, probably the best known parliamentary deputy that Die Linke has is one of the leaders of Aufstehen. So they have a very, very big profile. And I must say, I was unpleasantly surprised to see Jacobin run a major interview 10, 12 days ago with the leader of this current in Die Linke, in the left party, very, very uncritically. And I know from debates I've had with the editor of Jacobin one-on-one that this is a thought-out political position, which is very, to me, deeply problematic. But I don't want to suggest to you that my argument with these people was simply what I would call the morally and politically correct one, because I was also making, when I was in Germany, strategic arguments, and I want to underline those. For instance, one of the cities in which the Alternative for Germany has made advances is Chemnitz. Chemnitz is in the old East Germany, industrial working class town, very few non-white people. There's been very little immigration into Chemnitz. The people who are emigrating into Germany have been going to Berlin and Frankfurt and places like that. They haven't been going to Chemnitz, okay? But this right-wing anti-immigrant argument has been capable of building an organization in Chemnitz, bringing a few thousand people into the streets behind Alliance for Democracy, Alliance for Germany banners, AfD banners. And I would say it was 6 or 7 days before I arrived in Berlin. In Chemnitz, there was a mass anti-racist, anti-fascist festival which drew 60,000 predominantly young people. So one of my first questions to all of the people saying, oh, we got to back off on immigration, simply recognize, you know, push economic demands, was, who was there? Who were the 60,000? How did they get there? Who organized them? How are you following up with them? How are you translating their activism in going to an anti-racist, anti-fascist concert into an ongoing movement that can reclaim the streets in Chemnitz and so on? Well, of course, if your whole focus is electoral, you're not asking those questions. Fortunately, to their credit, there are other groups in Germany, some of them inside Die Linke. I spend a lot of time with activists with a current that's inside Die Linke that call themselves Marx 21, and the Marx 21 activists are doing some great work in this area, for instance. But the point is, there were 60,000 people out there, and they're predominantly young. Are there they largely the older white voters who are shifting over to the Alternative for Germany? No. But they're often their kids. And one of the things we know about past social radicalizations is that very often the young people being radicalized are the ones that go back into households and take on the parents, take on the aunts and uncles, argue them down on their drift to the right, basically put up political barriers to the shift to the right because they're prepared to mobilize. They're prepared to become part of social movements. Their confidence in political argument starts to grow through all of that and so on. And then, of course, some of you will know that 2 weeks ago, this weekend, 240,000 people turned out in the streets of Berlin for a mass anti-racist mobilization. And the leaders of Aufstehen, who've recently been given pages in Jacobin, deliberately did not attend the demo of 240,000. So I say that because I think there's a risk for the left right now that there's a notion that because some sections of working class people have drifted to the right, have been pulled by the Trumps of the world, have been pulled by the Alternative for Germany, have been pulled by the National Front in France, that what we need to do is adapt to their movement and take the cutting edge and the critical edge away from our politics. And that is, by the way, politically disastrous. You never win by ceding ground to begin with, but also it ignores the very real forces that are there to be mobilized against this trend, whether it's the 60,000 in Chemnitz or the 240,000 in the streets of Berlin. I will say as well, I haven't been to Britain. I'm going to be there later this year. I haven't been to Britain recently, so I haven't been directly in these debates, but I would say that the same thing applies in principle to the arguments of sections of the British left, including some who came out of earlier socialist feminist movements, their arguments against the legislation that is designed to create new forms of trans equality in Britain. And literally, I would argue, overtly transphobic arguments are coming out of sections of the British left right now. And a lot of the same kind of stuff you're hearing in the background. Oh, well, if you push this, you alienate working class people. Okay. And one of the things I really want to emphasize here is the working class is incredibly diverse in every possible. The working class is incredibly diverse in every possible way. I got the signal from the back to use the mic more effectively. And it is simply not true that there is a single social cultural norm that characterizes working class life in working class households. It's just silly to suggest that even in the 1950s stereotypical view of the so-called Fordist working class household with a mother at home and a working class father and the kids who always accepted that father knows best, that was ever a reality even in the 1950s. But even if you want to make a case that there was some reality to it in the 1950s, this society today is so radically different, it's ridiculous. This is a society that has not fully turned back on all of the social, political, and cultural gains of the last great wave of radicalization. It is simply not true that on LGBTQ rights, on women's rights, on fundamental basic anti-racist civil rights, that we've lost everything. The right, that's their agenda. Their agenda is to make sure that every one of those social cultural gains is eliminated. But from the right standpoint, if you ever look at their literature, one of the reasons that they believe some fictitious entity called cultural Marxism rules our society today, and they do, by the way, they actually think that, you know, cultural Marxism rules the universities, and so on. But one of the reasons is because they know that there's a series of social cultural transformations that have not been entirely rolled back and eliminated. And we need to understand that too, and to recognize, as I say, that diversity of the working class. So I want to now come to a few sort of concluding remarks, and then I really look forward to the discussion. One of the things I'm really trying to emphasize is that there are new constituencies for the left. And those new constituencies are in some cases measurable, tangibly measurable. Okay? And by that, I'll just use some of the examples I've already used. The 200,000 who've joined the British Labour Party to support Corbyn against the Blairite Third Way. The Democratic Socialists of America had about 6,000 members at the beginning of the Bernie Sanders campaign. They now have 52,000. I spent a couple of hours in Houston 3-4 weeks ago with one of the co-chairs of Houston DSA. They have 500 members in Houston. Just last weekend, and by the way, those 500 members have a whole series of working groups. So there's a racial justice working group, which is particularly working around prison issues and so on in the city. They also have a group right now that is mobilizing to defend drag queen story time at the Montrose Library in Houston, because every month on a Saturday afternoon at the Montrose Library in Houston, drag queens come and read stories to kids. And this has been going on for some time, and now the right is mobilizing against it. And DSA, to their credit, has joined with other groups to defend drag queen story time. This kind of grassroots organizing, many of you will know the involvement of lots of DSA groups in anti-ICE actions against immigration, customs enforcement, and so on. So it's a real development. I would argue the same applies for the two examples I've given from Germany, the 60,000 largely young people in Chemnitz and the 240,000 in the streets of Berlin. These are new audiences, and they're much, much larger than the left has had in a very, very long time. But one of the challenges it's going to mean for the left is the overcoming of all of the glorying in marginality that becomes really easy in periods where you don't have a growing audience. When you don't have a growing audience, it's really easy to get comfortable with the people you know and to get used to being a very marginalized social group and to become complacent with that. One of the things we've seen, and I would say, by the way, this has been probably the greatest achievement of the Fight for 15 campaign in this city, has to been to reach out, to actually get out into communities, going door to door, going to subway stops, signing people up, petitioning. The Tim Hortons actions, for instance, that were done about a year ago in this city, again, largely spearheaded by Fight for 15, are all about connecting with new constituencies. And I think the big achievement of the anti-Bannon demonstration on Friday night was that we moved from very small actions against the far right at City Hall over the past year to having over 1,000 people in the streets, because the point of that kind of action is not just to challenge the right. It's not just to make some of the people who went in to hear Bannon uncomfortable, but the more uncomfortable we made them, the better. But it's also to build our sense of capacity, our hopefulness about the resonance that our messages can have right now, and so on. And I think that's going to be a big challenge, so that some of the practices that have been around, we're going to have open and honest arguments and discussions about. And I'll just give you two examples. I know from speaking with organizers that the Labour Council executive in Toronto deliberately refused to support the anti-Bannon action because No One Is Illegal was one of the spearheading organizations. And we have to be able to go back to those people and say, that's a disaster. It is not acceptable that whatever differences you had with No One Is Illegal around some action in 2010 in Toronto, that becomes an obstacle to mobilizing Labour Council resources to fighting the far right today. On a smaller scale, I see my own Facebook feed often. A few dozen people who seem, their major pastime is bashing the Democratic Socialists of America. Well, I don't think the organization is perfect, by the way. I think there's a lot, and by the way, there are huge debates internal to it. But in the face of an insurgent far right, those are the comradely debates that we need while we're creating united fronts and common fronts of struggle. And I really believe that what we're seeing in one location after another, and I think one of the challenges here is going to be figuring out how to translate that into anti-Ford organizing in Toronto and across the province of Ontario in the next while. That was also, by the way, one of the reasons why the mobilization against Bannon was so important, because it's one of the largest, most militant actions that has happened since Doug Ford's election. And it's crucial to rebuilding the confidence and sense of solidarity of moving struggles forward in the months ahead. Now, I believe that, yes, it's going to be critical that radical traditions of socialism play a central role in these processes of political radicalization right now. I identify myself powerfully with the socialism from below tradition, which says that, no, there's not going to be an electoral parliamentary road to socialism. It's going to require insurgent mass struggles from below, which doesn't mean, by the way, that there'll be no electoral or parliamentary campaigns as an adjunct of that. It just means they cannot be an end in themselves, and so on. I also believe that that tradition has to be deeply renewed in the eras of late capitalism, when a whole variety of social oppressions that Marx or Lenin or Rosa Luxemburg or Gramsci never theorized have to be part of our political understanding. You're not going to find a lot in Marx on disability rights. You're not going to find a huge amount in Rosa Luxemburg on trans rights, for instance. But that's simply saying that our tradition has to be a living, developing one in relationship to the new struggles of the day. And so the socialism from below tradition that I tend to adhere to has to be deeply enriched by anti-racism, by feminism, by pro-queer and eco-socialist politics, and so on, by disability rights struggles. These have to inform that political perspective, as I say, as part of a living tradition. But I'll conclude by saying that, you know, the discussions that I've been involved with activists in Germany and the U.S. and, of course, here in Toronto over the last year or so have really convinced me that we are at an inflection point for the left too. And I think there are a lot of people in light of recent events who know the left can't continue the way it has been. That we've got to, as the expression goes, raise our game as well, because they're becoming increasingly deadly serious on the far right. And while that is frightening, and while that can produce moments of real despair on our side, there's a danger that we ignore the emerging constituencies that are out there and mobilizable and organizable. And I think that's going to be our task, to move radical socialism from the margins into becoming a much more significant social force. So let me stop there. I look forward to questions and discussion.